Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring, and we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, this next hour they're going to be the views of Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster, and we're going to be talking about what's happening to our financial system. But before we do, I wanted to read you something that appears in our Sustainable Development syllabus, but it actually comes from West Magazine. And, of course, in Colorado, a man named Maurice Strong, who was a multi-billionaire, who had very close ties to the Rockefeller family and to oil development, and has an occult center there where Satanists and witches and shamans and members of all the occult groups and people who practice the black arts come. It is an occult center. It's known as La Baca Grande. And a reporter was talking to Mr. Strong about you know, his view of what was going on in the world. And, of course, what Strong actually told him, he told him he had this recurrent dream. What if a small group of world leaders were to conclude that the principal risk to the earth comes from the actions of the rich countries? And if the world is to survive, those rich countries would have to sign an agreement reducing their impact on the environment. Will they do it? The group's conclusion is no. So in order to save the planet, the group decides isn't the only hope for the planet, that the industrialized civilizations collapse. Isn't it our responsibility to bring that about? And then this group of world leaders form a secret society to bring about an economic collapse. And that is what Maurice Strong, a multi-billionaire, told a reporter from West Magazine. We have the article, and you can see this reproduced in our Sustainable Development syllabus. And what brings this really to mind is I got the recent publication put out by, it's called The Emergence. It's an occult organization with ties into the New Age with millions of members here in America. And on page 3, it makes this statement, referring to Maitreya, the Christ. Of course, that's not Jesus Christ that we worship. That is the other Christ. He says it will take the collapse of our economic system, as we've known it, to bring us into a sense of reality, to realize that we cannot go on indefinitely in a world where one-third of the population uses three-quarters of the world's food and 85% of the other resources. So you have to understand there really are people who want to destroy our economic system. It is well on the way, and most people have no idea what's happening. They find that impossible to believe, and yet everything points to the fact that the current crisis is a managed and created crisis, and it's getting worse and worse day by day. Certainly with us this evening is a man who I consider one of the experts on this, Bob Chapman, who's been studying this for over 50 years. I've only been at it for 46. Bob, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be back again.
All right, fine. Well, now, this is a different audience, so you can certainly repeat some of the things you said. Bob was on one of our other programs this afternoon. And where are we headed at the present time?
First of all, I'd like to comment on your
commentary
out of West Magazine. Maurice Strong, if I'm not mistaken, is a Canadian.
Right.
And he was one of the proteges of David Rockefeller.
Right.
And there was another former head of the World Bank who evolved at around the same time. I can't recall his name. But Maurice Strong, up until a couple of years ago when they had this UN oil with...
Now hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here. Okay, Bob, go ahead. You were just saying that Maurice Strong got involved with that oil for whatever it was.
And he was the assistant secretary of the UN and had to resign because of it.
Right. I mean, talk about it. I mean, here's a man with billions of dollars, and he sacrifices everything to make an illegitimate million or two.
Yes.
I mean, just
multi-millionaire.
Right.
But they're all on the inside, and you know they control the Federal Reserve, so they have a license to steal. I think it's just as simple as that. Anyway, which facet should we start with this evening in this game of blind man's bluff here?
Well, my contention is that this thing is getting worse. That we've seen the beginning of the home foreclosures. That I don't really know. Do you have any idea how many houses have been foreclosed on so far? It sounds like a couple of hundred thousand. Do we have any idea what the figures are?
I don't have the figure anymore because we're into it. And I figured that of all the subprime ultra loans that were made, at least 50% would go bad. And I'm now starting to see figures to that effect. That probably would be a loss of somewhere between $750 and $1 trillion. $750 billion and $1 trillion. Then you have the additional losses that will be absorbed by those who purchased the mortgages on these homes. And you're talking another trillion. So the figure is going to range anywhere from $1.7 to $3 trillion. And the comment, I wrote about this guy the other day. He was under Secretary of the Treasury and ran the working group in financial markets, and now he's managing director of Carlyle Corporation. And he addressed an economics group, I don't know whether it was in New York or Washington, and told them that he believed that the losses would be in the trillions and that they would have to be subsidized by governments in order to keep the system from going under. And that is their plan. Also, he said that a number of banks will go under. Some of the better ones would be merged. And he said that they're trying to get legislation passed which
will allow
private entities to buy into.
Hold that thought. Okay. Okay, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Bob. Bob Chapman. Bob Chapman is saying that he thinks that it's going to be perhaps between $1 and $3 trillion that we're going to be lost with these banks. And then, of course, there's the CDOs, the collateralized debt obligations that the banks are holding. So you're going to lose an awful lot of money, of course, with the foreclosed homes. And we're probably talking between 1 and 2 million foreclosed homes. And then, of course, you're going to have the banks, the hedge funds, the pension funds that have bought these mortgages that are really worthless based upon those homes, those foreclosed homes. And so we're talking about a lot more money. Pick up the story there, Bob.
And he said that this legislation would allow private equity companies such as Carlyle to buy large portions of banks. And the private equity companies would have no trouble getting money to do that.
Now you're talking about
investment banking and banks that would be allowed to go under, and the people who earn on the inside would be allowed to survive. He's talking about fellow Illuminis.
All right, fine. Now, this is the head of Carlyle, formerly assistant head of the World Bank, who's talking to a group of people and saying that Carlyle is going to be able to pick up a lot of these shattered investment companies that have got the CDOs. Is that right?
That's correct. And so this is their plan. And, you know, it's interesting. I think that you and I are the only people on talk radio that I've heard talk about the calamity that we're in the middle of here, financially and economically, was planned deliberately. And from what you've just said, from the article from West Magazine, Maury Strong has said the same thing.
Right, and of course this is what it says in this little magazine I just got today from the occultists. It's called The Emergence. It's put out by the followers of Benjamin Krem, and they're talking about, oh, we're just going to have to destroy the economic system. People said that's crazy talk. Well, oh, we're not dealing with people who are necessarily sane, but these are some of the most powerful people in the world with the most powerful spiritual forces behind them, because Maurice Strong was deeply involved in the occult, and of course so is Benjamin Krem. In fact, he's the leader of this whole world occult movement. Go right ahead there, Bob.
So, obviously, that's their plan, and it's been planned that way. And it's hard for people to understand because it's so diabolical. It's hard enough to get people to believe in something simple rather than something so vast and encompassing. And so, as we, in our program, slog along trying to get people to understand what's going on, it's not an easy job because most people won't listen or don't want to understand.
Well, I mean, I really don't want to understand it either, Bob. I don't want to think about this wonderful utopian world that we live in simply being destroyed, but I think realistically we have to realize there are people who want to destroy it, and it looks like they're well on the way to that goal. And then, of course, powerful spiritual forces, I believe, are going to bring God's judgment on America. I think it's only a matter of time, and as Thomas Jefferson said, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice will not sleep forever. And I feel we're beginning to get that justice here. And a lot of people, over 200,000 people, 250,000 people have lost their homes, but this is just the beginning. And it's not simply the foreclosed homes, it's 80,000 people lost their jobs last month. And for 3 months now, there's been a marked increase in people losing their jobs, and money is not available. The housing industry has just collapsed. The building industry has collapsed. The financial industry has collapsed. The automobile industry is collapsing, and certainly, you know, they're going to be cutting back dramatically on the number of cars produced by GM and Ford and Chrysler this year. And the average American, as long as he's getting a paycheck, isn't aware of this, but I will tell you, everybody I talk to who's in business of one sort or another, they're all hurting, and each month things seem to be getting worse. So pick up the story, Bob.
Well, that is the case. One of the things I'm writing this evening about the unemployment report, and they created 142,000 jobs out of thin air. And so if you add that to the 80, which were supposedly lost, that's about 220,000. And even those figures don't make it. I think probably the losses were over 300 for the month. And it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. They had the U6 unemployment, which supposedly covers people who have given up looking for work, but they don't tell you how far back they go. Heck, there's people back to 1990 who haven't been employed. That's 18 years ago, and if you lost your job when you were 50, you're 68 now, 40, or you'd be 58 now. And those people are still out of work, but they don't count them either. And so that's why my figure in unemployment is around 14.38%. But these figures are going to continue to deteriorate. And people out there have got to get ready for it. You've got to get rid of your credit card and revolving debt. I know many of you have, and that's good. Automobile debt if you can. And if you have extra money, you should buy food and a method to defend your family and the other survival things that you would need. And you should plan on things being difficult for the next year or two, and after that, they're going to be worse. This housing crisis is just in the subprime alt-loan area. It's got a minimum of a year and a half to go. And then on top of that, just about a year and a half from now, most of the option pick-and-pay loans, which Wachovia said yesterday, and they're the ones who are writing them, they're not going to write them anymore.
Would you like to explain to our listeners what a pick-and-pay loan is? Because most of the people don't know these phrases.
Yeah, I thought our listeners knew everything.
Well, I'm afraid that these may be some new listeners. Anyway, why don't you explain once again what the pick-and-pay loan is?
Well, you have the option of paying a small amount of money, perhaps, let's say $600 or $700 a month.
No, this is somebody who takes out a loan, and you're given, you can pick what you're going to pay, and so you can pay $700 a month. Whereas ordinarily, of course, you should be paying an expensive loan, maybe $1,500 or $2,000 a month, but you don't have to pay that. You can pay less. Of course, the amount of money you're going to owe on the house is going to keep increasing, and instead of paying off the loan, you're going to be paying into an increasing loan. But go ahead, Bob.
You can pay interest only, or you can pay a combination of all three. And most people took those loans out because they would pay a small amount of money, and they also were planning on their homes gaining in value. And of course, unfortunately for them, in the last year or two, that hasn't happened. And so, and most of these people who have these option loans were people who had FOICs of 700 or higher. So they really didn't have to pick these loans. They could have picked a 30-year fixed and paid $1,500 or $1,800 a month, but they chose not to. They gambled in the market, and they've lost. And number one, a lot of these homes are in negative equity. And number two, can they get a loan? Is Wachovia going to stop issuing those loans?
And of course, Wachovia is one of the largest banks in the United States, and they're just not going to loan that way anymore. So that means that, of course, that people, if they're going to get a loan, they're going to have to put down maybe 20%. They're going to have good, certainly a good financial backing. And, of course, they're going to have to pay interest plus, you know, pay down part of the principal. They're not going to be able to just not pay down the principal or just pay on the interest and have the principal remain the same. They're going to have to start paying off their loans, or they're not going to loan. Is that about the way it's going to be, Bob?
Well, I think they got to get new loans. And, you know, let's assume they bought a home for $700,000 and put nothing down, and it's now worth $670,000. We'll be conservative and not, you know, take it to, you know, the 20% drop that houses have seen, which would have taken it down to 560. And but let's say it's 670, but they're still underwater on the loan. And in order to do the loan, which they have not been paying on, I mean, the small payment that they made didn't go into principal, so they still own $700,000. Now the question is, do they have $30,000 to come up with so that they can make a new loan on a fixed rate basis and pay perhaps $2,500 a month? And the answer is probably no.
And so they're going to stand there to lose their home, because they're going to have to refinance it. They're going to have to have increased payments, and they're going to have to, of course, have enough to pay that $30,000 in the value of the home that's been lost. And an awful lot of people are coming up with these situations. They don't have any money saved. As a nation, we're not saving, and as a result, when the crisis comes, why, of course, we stand to lose everything. Go right ahead, Bob.
And so this is going to add to the downside in the housing market in the more expensive homes. And that's going to throw more homes in the market. One of the things also I wrote about in Saturday's issue of the International Forecaster was that what the banks are doing now so that they don't have a vacant house when they should be putting somebody out of the house because they haven't made the payments for 6 months or whatever. They don't want to leave the house idle because what's happening is thieves are going into the homes and stripping the homes of anything that's usable, particularly copper piping and things like that. So the banks are absorbing even greater losses because of this mischief. And they also have decided, and it's been going on for the last few months, to even though these people can't make the payments or won't on the property, they're leaving them in the house. And that's to keep the house from being ripped apart or used as a brothel or whatever. And that is not reflected in the amount of housing inventory that's available for sale. Now, I would think that the banks must have some of these homes up for sale, but I don't know that. All I know is it's not a very good situation.
And so the banks are really, of course, losing money on this, and the banks have to make money or they go out of business. You have enough of these loans that are non-performing and you have no means of getting the money back. Why, you're in real trouble as a banker.
Well, there's no question. The banks are in trouble, and they're going to be in further trouble down the road because when all is said and done in the form of 30 hot areas, as they were called, on the way up, those areas are going to go down anywhere between 35% and 60% in value. And you have the main characters, which are California, Nevada, Arizona, and outside of Washington and Virginia, and in the south of Florida on both coasts, Atlanta, and so those areas are going to get hit probably for an average of around 45%. So the people out there are sitting in a home that they bought 4 years ago and they paid $300,000 and it went to $700,000 and now it's back down to say $550,000, a lot of the profit that they thought they had was gone. I think they'd still have a hard time getting an equity loan or a new loan on the house because I believe the banks have now realized how deep this correction is going to be. And I just think that these owners are in serious trouble.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. In my understanding, a lot of the banks, of course, as they've been encouraging people to take out home equity loans in the past, are not offering home equity loans at the present. And a lot of people, as the value of the property went up, why they were borrowing on their property like it was a piggy bank, taking out home equity loans and taking trips. And after all, it was their money they were spending, but it was only imaginary. And now the value of the property drops, and with the loan that they have on the house and the home equity, why, of course, that's a lot more than the house is actually worth and that they can sell it for, and that's going to create real problems down the line. Can the banks call in those home equity loans, Bob?
Yes, they can.
So these are callable loans, and of course, if the bank gets into trouble, they call your loan, and of course, then you've either got to pay it or you're going to have to give up the house. That's just the way the world works. But Already over a quarter of a million Americans have lost their homes, and another at least 600,000 are on the verge of losing them. We are in a downward spiral, and of course this is going to influence not only the subprime, but the people, you know, who the Alt-A, who under other circumstances would be able to make their payments, but even some people with good credit ratings are going to find that the houses they bought are worth a lot less than they paid for them. And are they going to continue making payments on houses that are worth less than the mortgage? Well, that's a good question. What do you think is going to happen, Bob?
I think as the houses go down in value, people with good credit are going to walk away. I think it's as simple as that, because if you paid $600,000 for a house and it's worth $500,000, you're not going to continue to pay on it. It doesn't get any more complicated than that. So the inventory that they're facing, which I think is about 9.4 months right now, I think it's going to grow even bigger.
And of course, houses just are not selling well. And of course, eventually people then have to lower the price to be able to sell the house. This is just the way the market works. And then, of course, if the house sells, is foreclosed on and sold at an auction, maybe for half of what it's worth, which is what happens at many of the auctions, that drives the value of the houses in the neighborhood down. And of course, we get this cascading collapsing of housing costs. Would that be a factor, Bob?
Yeah, it will be. There's some cities, with the exception of auctions, that you can't sell anything.
Right.
I mean, you take Durban, Michigan, Dearborn, you know, it's very, very hard to sell anything. I mean, you get blocks of houses with nobody in them, and it looks like a war zone. And, you know, cities are very upset about it, and rightly so, because being in the state that they're in, the value goes down, and so does the real estate tax. And they can't do what they want to do as far as fixing the roads and so on.
I thought it was very interesting that the federal government's approach to what was going on, they were going to set up $100 million for counseling the 250,000 people who have lost their homes so they wouldn't feel so bad about having lost their homes. That's equivalent to about $4,000 for each person who's lost a home. But, and then the other thing they were going to do, they were going to give communities money so they could get the lawns fixed up and get these houses fixed up that have been abandoned so that the areas wouldn't look blighted, so that the towns would look nicer. The federal government's going to give cities money so they can fix up empty homes that have been foreclosed on. We live in a world gone mad. That is how the federal government is going to solve the problem.
That's what they think.
Well, of course, they're not really... I think people have to understand it's all smoke and mirrors. They don't intend to solve the problem. They're going to get to give the public out there, the voting public, the idea that they're trying to do something where they're not trying to do anything. They have no intention of solving the problem, because there really are people who would like to see the whole economic system collapse. And so they'll talk about it. But, I mean, do you really think that counseling people who've lost their homes is going to solve the problem? Do you think that giving money to cities so they can fix up the homes and mow the lawns on the homes that have been abandoned is going to solve the problem? But the legislators back there are really working hard for us, aren't they? Go ahead, Bob.
I don't think they're doing anything.
I don't think they are either. I think it's all smoke and mirrors, as they said.
Well, they allocated, I think it was $60 million for counseling.
Right.
And these people don't need counseling.
They need a place
to live.
The whole
thing is ridiculous.
Right.
I think it's just going to get worse.
Right, and I think it's going to get a lot worse, because it's not just the CDO bubble and the housing bubble. There's the hedge fund bubble. There's the derivative bubble. And of course, we're talking about more money that exists in the whole world today. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. Our friend Bob Chapman is with us this evening. We're talking about what's going on financially. We've been trying to warn people for years to begin making preparations, and some of those people who took our advice several years ago are sitting pretty. They sold their homes. They bought homes in areas where the prices were not inflated. One of our friends ended up with three or four duplexes to rent, and he's set for life. But the average person just couldn't believe it was going to happen. And because if we do nothing, it'll go away. And the trouble is, it's not going to go away. We're not only talking about a collapsing economic system. We're talking about collapse of the food system. There are food riots all throughout the world. People are facing starvation in 20 or 30 countries. And yet, most people blithely, simply go to the store and think that there's never going to be a problem here in America. But go right ahead, Bob.
I think the food prices are going to become an even more pressing factor, as will energy. I read a piece by an oil man today, and he said that in the next week or so, it's possible that oil could go to $160 a barrel.
Well, now, is that taking into account the fact we might get into a conflict with Iran or what?
No. Just the usage factor and the fact that the producers of oil are running pretty much at full capacity. And, yes, there's been some fall off of the United States in usage, but the rest of the world is still going up. And so I don't think they're going to find any respite overall in the demand for oil. And of course, as you mentioned, these maniacs in the White House want to invade Iran or Kosovo or both. And that's continuing with some kind of a premium on oil prices. Food prices, unless they stop in the United States and Europe producing ethanol or any kind of biofuel, the cost of food is going to continue to go up exponentially. There's just no two ways about it. So people's costs are going to go up considerably.
All right, you hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Bob, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you if they'd like to get a free copy of the International Forecaster and perhaps even consider subscribing?
Well, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. We publish on Wednesday and Saturday. It's about 28 pages each time. And we also have a hard copy that goes out twice a month. If you'd like to visit our site to get a free introductory copy, you can go to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International Forecaster, FORECASTER.com. If you'd like to email us, if you've got a question, the address is international_forecaster@yahoo.com. international_forecaster@yahoo.com. And if you want to call toll-free, you can call 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Well, you know, Bob was talking about, of course, this disaster, which is ethanol. Now, ethanol is not a good solution to the oil problem. The solution to the oil problem would be to allow offshore drilling, to allow drilling in the Arctic Life Wildlife Reserve, to develop the massive pools of oil off the North Shore of Alaska. If you haven't got our four-tape set on oil, four tape or four CD set on oil. You need to get it. There's lots of oil out there. In fact, if you read my articles on oil, why, I've had producers tell me, if you just put a floor of $25 a barrel, we'd go ahead and start trying to develop oil in the United States. But every time, of course, they try, then, of course, big oil comes in, drops the price down to $10 a barrel, puts them out of business, and they've been stung like that over and over again, so they're not about to do that. There's plenty of oil out there. But, of course, the last thing that the big oil wants is for any competition. And so unless there's a floor under oil, why, they will destroy their competition. And, of course, right now, of course, we may very well be looking at a $120, $140, $160, $200 a barrel oil. Because, of course, you have a monopoly, and you have just a few large oil companies who own the oil refineries, and, of course, they finance the environmental movement that's very effectively used to destroy their competition. That's how the game is really played. But Bob was simply talking about ethanol and the fact that ethanol is not a good solution. What it's doing, it's using up corn. Corn is over $6 a bushel, which means that the price of chickens, chicken feed goes up. Chickens eat corn. The price of meat goes up because, of course, they use corn to fatten the cattle in the slaughter yards. And then the price of eggs goes up. The price of milk and other products, dairy products, goes up as well. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that the price of food is going to keep going up and up and up as long as the government interferes in the market and as long as the government continues destroying the value of our currency. Because as the value of our currency goes down, certainly the Arab countries want to make as much as they did 20 years ago when the dollar was worth about four times what it is today. And so it is little wonder that the price of oil goes up as the value of the dollar goes down. It's not that the price of oil is actually increasing. It's not increasing in other countries. It's simply increasing here. And it is increasing here because our dollar is being destroyed effectively and intentionally by the people in the Federal Reserve System. When you increase the money supply, why, of course, you decrease the value of the currency. Would that be a fair estimate, Bob?
Absolutely. And this is all part of the plan we discussed earlier in the program to take down not only the U.S. economy, but the European and Canadian economy and the rest of the economies throughout the world will have the same problems. And it's to bring everybody down to one level. And
everybody except the Al Gores of this world and the other people of his ilk, people of great, great wealth, who are trying, of course, to do everything they can to destroy industrialized civilization. That's what the global warming scam is all about. The only way, of course, we're going to cut down greenhouse emissions is to stop flying in airplanes. You hear all this talk recently about how terrible the airlines are, and my goodness, three airlines just shut down this last week. What they really want to do is to get us to stop flying in airlines, to destroy the airline industry. They want to get us out of our cars. They want to get us onto bicycles so we could be just like the people in Beijing used to be, happily pedaling, you know, to the store to get our food and then happily pedaling back to our homes. They want to change our entire level of lifestyle. They don't want us using heat in the winter or air conditioning in the summer. They've driven up the price of electricity artificially. And that was a wonderful scam when they talked about deregulation of electricity to lower the prices. Oh, my goodness, we want to bring competition in. You can't bring competition into a monopoly. What they did was confuse the people, get them to go along with deregulation, and then massively increase the price, not lower the price of electricity. And, of course, it's going to be pretty soon increasingly difficult for people to be able to afford the simple necessities of life, and that's exactly what they want. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I agree with that, and I think you covered it very well. And what we've talked about earlier in the program, and you know, I think the bottom line here is we just got to get more people to listen. I had an interesting comment in the show I was on this morning by the hostess, who is Joyce Riley on the Power Hour, and she said, you know, people are talking about the Federal Reserve and about the fact that it's not a government organization. And she said, this is really, really surprising. You know, we tried for years to get everybody to understand about the Fed, and we were relatively successful, but in a small way. But now, because of what's going on, people are discovering that the Fed is not good for us. And, you know, we may be in the throes of a public outrage over what the Fed has done. And were we to get Congress replaced by throwing all the incumbents out, we might be able to get something accomplished along those lines of getting rid of the Fed.
Yeah, it was really very interesting that you say that, Bob. I was listening to a recording of Ron Paul's, Congressman Ron Paul's interview with George Norrie. It was about 2 weeks ago, I guess, and George Norrie was saying, well, you know, simply the Fed is not a branch of the federal government. It's a privately owned central bank, and do you think we could get rid of the Fed? And they were talking about it, and of course, Ron Paul said, well, we can't get rid of them all at once. But what we need is a two-tiered monetary system, one based upon gold, and then if people want to use the paper money, they can, but of course it's going to lose value, whereas gold will maintain its value, and that is the currency that will be the ultimate one to survive. But, you know, the fact that George Norrie would come out and admit to his massive listening audience that the Federal Reserve is not a branch of the federal government. It's a privately owned central bank created by the bankers for the bankers to enrich the bankers. And until the American people understand that, nothing's going to change.
Well, I think it's becoming more and more visible to people, and that's good. Whether we can get enough people disgruntled enough to force Congress to change that back to the Treasury remains to be seen. But we're going in the right direction. It's just, you know, the question is, are we too late? I mean, after 50 years or so, us old guys kind of get worn out.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to open up our lines here if anybody would like to call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and somebody just called in. And a caller wanted to ask, if you don't buy gold or silver, is it safe to put your money into a mutual fund or the bond market? How would you respond to somebody who wants to know if they should put their money into mutual funds or bond market? Don't just laugh out loud, Bobby. Go ahead and tell them why they shouldn't.
Well, I think the first line of defense is people getting the basic things in that you need, get out of debt and things like that. And then I think they should consider gold and silver assets, and the first thing they should get is coins. And if they have a fair amount of money, then they should consider gold and silver stocks. Interest rates are eventually going to go up. They're going down. They'll probably go down again before June. We might see the Fed funds rate at 1.75% to 2%, and it could go even lower. But after that's over, interest rates are going to go up. And when interest rates go up, bonds go down. And so you want to sell bonds at the top of the market. I think we're approaching the top of the market in bonds, and I think the same with the stock market, even though it's manipulated by the government. So being in a mutual fund, or a mutual fund with bonds, or a mutual fund with stocks, is extremely dangerous. And I've been telling people to go to cash and gold and silver related assets. That cash being put into Swiss franc government bonds. If they don't do that, don't want to do that, they can buy treasuries. Whatever they want to do, but being out of the stock market and bond markets in general, I think is a very good idea.
And I think that's absolutely right. The person wants to know if it's hard to get gold or silver coins.
Well, it's pretty easy. I mean, the coin dealers on in every city in the world, particularly in the United States, so I don't see any trouble purchasing coins.
Although isn't there a shortage?
Want reputable dealers, we can recommend some, and be helpful in that way. And also, stockbrokers that specialize in gold and silver shares.
Right.
We can do that for you too. There's no charge.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to let's see. We'll call to Mike, who's calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing? Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I have a question about the Fed and what Bob was just saying a few minutes ago about the general awareness was being raised. And once enough of that happens, then we can do something. Well, I'm just wondering what that would be, because it seems like Congress is the only entity that's supposed to have any kind of power to actually change things with them. It just seems too much like our governmental structure is an economic structure now, rather than, or that's what it's headed to, rather than a political or a legislative structure. It's been replaced.
Well, that's a good take on it.
Yep.
A very good take. And I think you're right about that. And if we can't do it through Congress, you know, we're right back where the founding fathers were in this country. They had to run the British out. And we may have to take our government back.
All right, anything else, Mike?
What they've got going is like a cancer that is really spread through the whole body. And I keep thinking about it. It only seems like the best thing is to continue on trying to raise awareness.
Well, our job is to raise awareness. Our job is to make people understand what freedom is about, and that freedom once lost will never be regained, and that without freedom, life has very little meaning. And of course, you may think you're free, but when they control your money, when they control, you know, when they have dossiers on everybody in America, when they can track you with your cell phone, even when it's off, when they can listen to your conversation on your cell phone, even when it's off, I mean, you'll find, of course, that they are doing everything to set up a police state. And why would they have everything in place? Why would they repeal posse comitatus? Why would they allow people to be arrested as military combatants simply because they've been charged? Why would they justify the use of torture and the use of evidence, you know, obtained by torture in military courts, where military combatants will be tried? And, of course, where there's no right of habeas corpus, where there's no judicial review. And if you, they say you can only use it on non-citizens, but if you're a citizen and you're in prison and there's no just judicial review and habeas corpus, how would you ever prove you're an American citizen? They did it to Padilla. They tortured him and totally destroyed that man because he turned down their offer to become, of course, a snitch for the government.
Well, I think they've done all those things. They've made those changes because they knew or know what would happen when people's awareness was raised.
And they did away with the Posse Comitatus law when they passed the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act in 2006. Mike, God bless you. Thanks very much for calling. And suddenly somebody had called here and they wanted to say, can the government take away our gold and silver? Like they did in 1933. How do you answer that, Bob?
Well, they can, but I don't think they're going to do that. And the reason why is that not enough people own gold and silver to make it worthwhile. And if they, anything, they would go after the gold and ETF, which is called StreetTrax. And there's 640 tons of gold there, and they might nationalize that and give people dollars in return, but I don't see any move towards confiscation at all. And I just don't think it's not necessary for them.
And I think, as people have to realize, the government can do whatever it wants to. George Bush is signing statements where he says, you know, I signed this, this legislation into law, but I won't obey it. He has signing statements where he says, I'm signing this, but I will not obey this law. I mean, we have an imperial presidency, ladies and gentlemen. We have a very dangerous man in the White House who suspended Posse Comitatus, who set his situation up where he can take control of the state National Guard without the permission of the state governor. And, of course, you know, how did he get this power? It's unconstitutional, but he doesn't believe in the Constitution. In fact, I had him... the time I met him, Somebody asked him, if you were asked to sign a piece of legislation that was unconstitutional, what would you do? And his reply was, I don't understand the question. I don't understand the question. That is the man who today is the President of the United States, who says, I don't care what the laws are, I'm above it. I have the right to torture anyone I want to. That is my prerogative, because I'm the Commander-in-Chief. Well, let's quickly go to Maggie, who's calling from Texas. We'll get to Roger in just a moment. Maggie, did you have a quick question for our guest?
I've heard that if you do own physical gold, when you try to cash it in, there's a huge tax on it, something like 27 or 30%, and I would like to know, first, is that true? Secondly, is it a tax? To whom does it go? How does it work?
Okay, Bob, what's your answer to that?
Well, I heard about that tax, and that's true, and that would go to the federal government. I don't know if states have taxes, but the federal government does, and you're right about the treatment.
Okay, we're
going
to have
to happen.
Hold that thought right there. Okay, go ahead, Bob.
I think a lot of people will be doing transactions between one another rather than selling through coin dealers. I see that happening in a big way, because very few people will want to pay the tax. And so I see a large black market forming because of that.
And Maggie, you don't want to, Chris, sell the coins for a long time, and not because they've got a long way up to go.
Mm-hmm.
It may be all that you'll have, of course, to be able to maintain any of your wealth. Thanks for calling. Anything else you want to ask before we let you go?
No, and I appreciate that answer.
God bless. And let's go to Roger from Allentown. Roger, you have a quick question for us.
Yes, thanks. Bob, I'd like to ask you if you would have just, say, a rough grand total, minimum figures of how many hundred billion have been inflated into the currency over the last whatever X number of months.
Well, since last August, the Federal Reserve has increased the amount of money that they have lent out to businesses, financial in nature, and banks by probably around $800 billion. And they've been lending money as well to the European Central Bank, as well as the Bank of England, Bank of Switzerland, and the Bank of Canada. And so I think $1 trillion is a conservative estimate. And then the European Central Bank has lent out over $1 trillion. And if you throw in the rest of them, that's probably another $500 billion. So you're probably looking at $2.5 trillion that's been injected in Europe, Canada, and the United States already. So it's a substantial amount of money.
But
plus
not all
what they're
that,
creating in money and credit through the M3 process.
Now, you didn't imply that the Europe share was U.S. dollars. That was their own currency?
It is, but the Fed's been lending them money. Now, not the entire amount, but some of the money that they've needed. I wrote about a month ago, or maybe it was two, about the European Central Bank for about 4 months was feeding the Spanish banks money and credit so that they wouldn't collapse. And eventually, you know, like a week ago, it came out that they were doing that.
We're going to have to let you go, Bob. Thanks very much, Roger. And Bob, thank you so very much. Well, our guest has been Bob Chapman. Bob, are you still there?
Still there.
All right. Well, Bob's gone, but I hope you enjoyed our program with him. We always do. And as he's talking about, they've actually put out about $1 trillion new since last August. Now, you have to understand, before that, the total amount of money that we had in circulation was about $700 billion, and they put out almost $1 trillion. Simply since last August, they're massively increasing the money out there, and that's what inflation's all about. And that's why, of course, the value of the dollar is falling. And, of course, that's why very, very soon we may find we'll have a runaway inflation in America, just as we, of course, imposed upon other countries throughout the world during the previous several decades. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing new under the sun, but we're going to see the destruction of the value of our currency. And, of course, as Alan Greenspan says in his book, is the age of turbulence. He quotes Lenin as saying there's no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch the currency, and not one person in a million will know what's happening. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you listen to Radio Liberty, at least you're going to know what's happening, and hopefully you can take some defensive actions, and hopefully you'll tell others about what's really going on. Help us get the truth out about what's going on. Certainly, if you haven't yet read my little pamphlet on the history of money, and then another pamphlet on the financial meltdown, they are available through Radio Liberty. My talk on the financial tsunami with the syllabus we think is important will give you a grasp of what is really happening and how all of these various factors, the carry trade, the hedge funds, the derivatives, what they are and how they're going to impact on you. The derivative market is somewhere between $600 and $700 trillion. The derivative market is somewhere between $600 and $700 trillion, as Warren Buffett said so well. Derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction. They are currently latent, but potentially lethal, and they are lethal to our financial system. They're lethal to the survival of our nation. Understand this, and of course all these quotations and many more are certainly in our syllabus, the financial tsunami, which we recommend to you. And certainly you have to remember, of course, what Aristotle had said. He said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money, as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And, of course, Daniel Webster said, of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. And Alan Greenspan, writing in 1965 in his essay on the gold and freedom, said this: in the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. That's what Alan Greenspan said in 1965. It's absolutely true. We carry the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. We suggest you get it, you read it. It's the best single book on what's going on today. We ordinarily will put out almost 20 of them every single week through one means or another. People all throughout the world are getting them from all over the world are getting them through Radio Liberty. And then, of course, we carry the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Anthony Sutton. And then, of course, we carry the book entitled Fiat Money Inflation in France. All of these are important. We want to remind you Radio Liberty is still primarily listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you who listen to our program to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every single week in an effort to educate the people and make them understand what freedom is really all about. And so if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Our webpage is radioliberty.com, radioliberty.com, where you can see many of our DVDs free of charge. Listen to our programs 9 hours a day free of charge. Won't get much accomplished. But to read our newsletters, we need you to get this information to other people. Encourage them to listen to Radio Liberty, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so, well, we'll be back in just a few minutes with the next program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And well, for this next hour, our guest is going to be Dr. Garth Nicholson. And Dr. Nicholson was the MB Anderson a clinic and taught medical school in Texas for 25 or more years. He had to leave there because, of course, he'd begin to investigate the origins of the Gulf War illness and other strange illnesses where they were experimenting on prisoners at the Huntsville, Texas prison there in Huntsville, Texas. And, of course, this precipitated an epidemic of multiple sclerosis and, of course, Lou Gehrig's and other degenerative neurological diseases. And you don't see this in epidemics unless, of course, there is some very strange things going on. And there were a lot of strange things going on. They were experimenting on the prisoners there. And, of course, the diseases they were giving to the prisoners were getting into the guards and into their families and spread throughout the community. And of course, a number of people died under very mysterious circumstances. Some of the doctors who were investigating this. And, well, that's, of course, why Dr. Nicholson came to California, really, along with his wife, because their life had been actually threatened because of what they were doing. And Dr. Nicholson's written a wonderful book, which we carry, called Project Daylily. Project Daylily reads like a Tom Clancy novel, only it's true. It's written as fiction, but it's really based upon fact because I know so many of the people there. But Dr. Nicholson's kind enough to come with us this evening to actually talk about some of these new chronic intracellular diseases that are plaguing literally millions of people in America and throughout the world. And the average doctor doesn't know anything about these because he's specifically not being told. Certainly the Army doctors are being told about it. They have special sessions on the mycoplasma infections in the Armed Forces Medical School, but the average physician doesn't know. He doesn't know what to do with the diseases. And so I'm going to let Dr. Nicholson pick up the story, but I've asked him to talk about Morgellons disease, which is a new terrible disease. And there are all these terrible new diseases, but of all the terrible new diseases, Morgellons sounds certainly the most horrible sort of disease. Entirely new, never existed before. Where did it come from? Dr. Nicholson, you pick up the story.
Well, Morgellons disease has actually also been called fiber disease. And the reason that it has that name is that the fibers are extruded from the sores that contain what we think are hybrid parasites that make these fibers. People that have this disease have been called delusional. Some of them have been actually put in psychiatric institutions. Some of them have been so horribly scarred by this and also scarred by the fact that they could not get any help at all from the medical community that they ended up committing suicide. But it is a real disease. And it's growing in incidence and it's spreading. And we think that actually casual contact may be able to spread this disease. It's mainly composed of these skin lesions that I mentioned that extrude these fibers. And the fibers can be black, white, or even colored. But this leads people to these kind of creepy, crawly sensations on their skin. And they end up scratching themselves and causing ulcerations, and this is where most physicians think that people are delusional and are causing it themselves, scratching themselves, creating sores, and then the clothes that they wear, the fibers from those clothes get into the sores. But that doesn't appear to be the case. In fact, we think that this is a real unusual disease right out of science fiction.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson, and an awful lot of people have this disease today. An entirely new disease. Well, now these people have this feeling that something's crawling under their skin, don't they?
They do, and in fact, there may be something crawling under the skin because the people that have looked into this have actually been able to detect forms. Some of them call them tubes. Other forms are almost like small parasites that are under the skin, and these can be actually removed from the people that have these. But there are also a lot of other problems that these cause. They cause fatigue, they cause cognitive problems, behavioral effects, and that's why people have been branded with bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, when in fact they, you know, they're being driven nuts because they have these crawling things under their skin. The fibers are the most interesting of all. They've been described as various types of synthetic fibers, but they're not synthetic, actually. They're actually generated, we feel, by the organism that's in the skin. And the organism is kind of complex. It seems to be a hybrid organism. It has aspects of insects, aspects of parasites, and there are also bacteria associated with it. And the bacteria cause their own problems. One of the bacteria that's been found associated with this is the bacterium Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, and mycoplasma that's also present in Lyme disease. So these are some of the common problems that these people have. And there's very little research that's really gone on this, and it's very difficult to treat this disease. But in fact, there are a number of things that can be done, and people have gone to our website to download a document on Morgellons disease at the Institute for Molecular Medicine, and that website is www.immed.org. It's like a media.org. And under the treatment considerations part of the website, there is a document on Morgellons, how it's identified, how it's treated. Even if it's not very successful, the treatments do alleviate some of the pain and the problems associated with it. Now, we have found, working with the Morgellons people themselves, a number of things that help. And most recently, we've been investigating the role that UV lamps play in helping these people alleviate these skin conditions, and that does appear to be some help. But there are other things that help as well, and there are a variety of ways in which you can keep this from spreading, and here's part of the problem. Evidently, this is spread from the skin by touching other individuals or even objects, and can spread to other individuals or even to pets. And so, unfortunately, as we found with the mycoplasma story, whole families can get contaminated and come down with these illnesses, including their pets. And in some cases...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. We'll be right back with our station. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Nicholson is saying this Morgellons disease is really a very real disease. There appears to be some sort of an insect, but it's really not an insect. It has a part of an insect, part of a bacteria, part of various living organisms, and these seem to crawl underneath the skin. And these then, of course, actually exude fibers through the skin. It's the most incredible thing. Dr. Nicholson was saying you can go to his website, immed.org. That's I-M-M-E-D, like immediate, immed.org, and there's a description there of the things that you can do. There's no effective treatment, but ultraviolet light seems to help, and you pick up the story there, Doctor.
Yeah, and there are also a number of products, including calamine spray, for example. Other people have used betadine antiseptic solution to try and keep down these infections. Acne skin products, and soaps and so on, seem to help. And people that have this have to keep their clothing dry. They have to wash everything, including their bedding, their clothes, everything, almost on a daily basis. And so it really is a horrible problem to keep this from spreading. It's a very difficult disease.
And of course, Dr. Nicholson was saying that, Cynthia, you can actually get the disease by touching somebody with this disease or something that they've touched, and you come in contact with that, you can come down with this terrible disease. It's contagious, just like so many of the mycoplasma diseases that our Gulf War troops came home with after the first Gulf War. Of course, it was spread throughout the family. And, of course, all of these diseases are communicable, not only to wives but to children. Whole families came down with these other diseases. Have whole families come down with Morgellons disease?
Well, apparently so. It's not a highly contagious process. It's evidently some contact is required. We're not sure exactly how much contact is required. Some of the other infections that we've dealt with, like the mycoplasma, are actually airborne infections that can be spread in the air. They're also not highly contagious, but they can be spread with prolonged contact. And this appears to be one of those things that requires prolonged contact. It's increasing in incidence, but we have no idea of the case of Morgellons, how many people have this, and the range of signs and symptoms in those individuals, and where they got it. So there's absolutely no information out there, because there's absolutely no money available to work on this as a problem, because it's being totally ignored and dismissed as delusional by the medical community. But I assure you, it's a very real problem, and the people that have this are suffering, and with absolutely no help whatsoever from the institutions that should be looking into this and helping them.
And of course, you can go up on the internet, go to look up in Morgellons disease. You'll find a lot of websites. There's a lot of interest in it. Other people are on the internet, but none from the medical profession. That's the tragedy. And where's the CDC when you really need them? Do they keep track of it? Do they have any sort of making any sort of an effort to find out how many people are infected? Is this a reportable disease?
Well, they've been pushed and prodded into beginning to study this, and I'm not sure what they've done, actually. But the CDC is a very reactive rather than proactive organization, so they need to be pushed and prodded to do anything about it. And their initial work is a lot of individuals trying to dismiss this as, a delusional problem with mainly people with bipolar problems. But that doesn't appear to be the case, because there are a lot of people, perfectly normal people in terms of their psychiatry, that have this problem. And they do have, some real manifestations, particularly of their skin. So it's not something that they're causing themselves, and they're certainly not inventing these fibers. And here's one of the mysteries. The fibers have been very hard to analyze. At first they thought they were fibers from the clothing that the people wore, but that proved not to be the case. They weren't cotton. They weren't synthetics. They turned out to be, produced, as you produce from a silkworm or something. Something biological seems to be making the fibers. And here's where the real mystery, as I mentioned, comes in, because when they start to try and figure out what it is, they find that, it has aspects of insect, it has aspects of parasite, it has aspects of bacteria. They don't know where to start on it. And we've seen this problem before. The ability of biological warfare laboratories to splice in various genes and form chimeric types of organisms that cause all kinds of new diseases that have never been seen before. And I think that this may be another example of that, unfortunately.
Well, of course, certainly there's no question that we know that the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology holds a patent on this mycoplasma fermentans, which, of course, would appear to have been genetically altered mycoplasma that has infected so many people today. Would you like to bring our listeners up to date on the mycoplasma? Is the mycoplasma fermentans, or is it the mycoplasma fermentans incognitus, and is there a difference between them?
Well, the difference is the incognitus strain, which is a strain of the mycoplasma fermentans, is thought to be the one that's been genetically modified to make it more pathogenic, to make it more survivable, for example, to make it able to survive a very dry climates, for example, to make it so that it can form little cysts, for example, that are metabolically inactive and so on. All these sorts of manipulations that we feel have been done to some of these microbes, these new microbes that are being studied, are exactly the types of things that you would do to weaponize them. That is to make them harder to find, to make them more stealthy, to make them more resistant to treatment, for example, to make them more survivable. If you delivered them, for example, via a rocket warhead or something. So all of these different things we feel are indicative of a weaponized microbe. And we don't know about any genetic manipulation in the Morgellons disease organism, whatever it turns out to be. But because it has all these different elements of insect, parasite, bacteria, whatever, it's undoubtedly one of these chimeric forms that experiments being conducted on it, and maybe on certain individuals without their knowledge, or maybe it got loose from a laboratory somewhere. We just don't know.
Well, because I think anybody who doubts that there is a plan to create diseases that will create chronic disability, I suggest they read the book by Zygmunt Bzezinski. It's entitled Between Two Ages, American the Technotronic Era, and it was came out in 1970. And one of the footnotes, somewhere between pages 55 and 65, I think it's on page 59, but it's somewhere in that part of the book, where Bzezinski talks about how in the future we're going to be able to create storms and droughts, and we're going to be able to create chronic illnesses. We're going to have organisms that will create chronic illnesses and that we can use against the enemy. And, of course, this is Zygmunt Bzezinski's book. So they were planning back in 1970 on creating these terrible, terrible diseases. And we have so many of our people who are afflicted with them today. And suddenly we have chronic fatigue, and we have fibromyalgia, and we have Lyme disease. And are there any other large groups that I'm missing? Of course, we have AIDS, but that's certainly, would that fit into the same category?
Well, I think it probably does. All these different emerging illnesses that are based on microorganisms, we haven't seen anything like this in the past. These are new emerging illnesses, and we think that these chimeric weaponized microorganisms may be causing these new illnesses, and certainly increasing the likelihood that the people have, for example, autoimmune type illnesses, or as you mentioned before, neurodegenerative and autoimmune illnesses. And so all these different illnesses that just are skyrocketing in incidence, and we have no explanation for it. They used to be very rare, and all of a sudden they're becoming quite common, and often they're associated with these different infections. When we started looking at the veterans that came back from the Gulf War, that showed an alarming increase in Lou Gehrig's disease, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. This is a neurodegenerative disease that results in parts of the brain literally dying and leaving you essentially paralyzed, unable to breathe and swallow and various other things. And that's really the fatal course of the disease, which is a very horrible course. And the incidence turned out to be very, very high in the Gulf War veterans, very unexpected. And all of these, 100% of these veterans that had ALS that we measured had this unusual Mycoplasma fermentans. There was only one exception, which was an Australian veteran with ALS, and he had a Mycoplasma infection, but it turned out he had this Mycoplasma genitalium. We didn't expect that at all. This is kind of an unusual Mycoplasma that's normally associated with venereal diseases, but this one had been modified, and now all of a sudden it's causing all kinds of other types of diseases that were literally unheard of in terms of this particular microbe. So there are a lot of examples of this. Now, Lyme disease is probably another example of a laboratory creation that got out of control and spread from Plum Island to Connecticut and also to Long Island itself, and caused the Lyme disease, the sort of classical problem of Lyme disease, which is a tick-borne disease. And Lyme disease is not a simple disease. In addition to the Borrelia or Dorfi, which is the main component of Lyme disease, there are a number of co-infections, including Mycoplasma, and Mycoplasma fermentans being the most prominent of the co-infections, as well as some other bacteria and even parasites that are involved in that. So these are very complex diseases.
Well, they really are. And, Chris, really what's so puzzling about this, when I went to medical school, because that was a long, long time ago, 50 years ago or more, 55 years ago when I graduated, we'd never heard of the mycoplasm. In fact, I'd never heard of the mycoplasm until it was about 1980 when they began talking about atypical pneumonia, and about a quarter of the atypical pneumonias were related to a mycoplasm. I had no idea what a mycoplasm was, and then we began to see this presenting as influenza here, an entirely new disease. I'm sure the mycoplasm had been around for a long time, but had not been pathological, and something happened. Something happened that made it become a very, very dangerous for human to encounter. Well, somebody had called in and wanted to know if Morgellons disease is it's found in certain parts of the United States or in certain groups of people. Is there any predilection, racial predilection for this, or certainly a geographic predilection?
Well, we do know that most of the cases have been reported in Florida, Texas, and California, and we're not sure whether that's because there are larger populations in those states or whether it's centered in those states, but there are also surrounding states that have been involved, Oklahoma, Arkansas, for example, and so on. So it's not just centered in certain locations, although there is a predominance of cases in these locations. And there also seems to be, at least in some cases, a link to military bases, that the people that are either ex-military or live near military bases have come down with this, and there's no explanation for that. So that's another interesting aspect of this.
All right. Well, of course, you were talking about Lyme disease and how Lyme disease is not simply the Borrelia. It involves other of these chronic intracellular infections. You mentioned, of course, the relationship to the mycoplasma fermentans in Lyme disease. Are there some other chronic intracellular diseases go along with the Lyme disease diagnosis?
Yes, there are other bacteria, for example, Ehrlichia species of bacteria, which is a well-known, rather old species of bacteria, disease-borne bacteria. Also bacteria Babesia, Bartonella, other bacteria, and intracellular parasites or protozoans that go along with that. And in fact, if you examine the ticks that carry Lyme disease, they carry all these different infections together, the same tick. And so when you're bitten by this tick, you end up with literally all these multiple infections at once, and that kind of overwhelms your immune system. And those people that are not can't fight this off, eventually they'll go through a course, maybe an acute course, which doesn't last very long, but then it becomes chronic, and then it causes the real problems, because it can spread to the central nervous system, causing neurosis, for example, and it can cause arthritis, for example, and other different autoimmune type problems. And so people can end up with all kinds of different difficulties because of this multiple infection that occurs by the bite of a tick. Now, Lyme disease itself is spreading across the United States, although most of the cases were in New England. It's spread from New England to the mid-Atlantic states, to the Midwest, and now to Texas and the southern states, and even out to the West Coast, Northern California, up to Washington. So all of a sudden it's spread across the U.S., and it's become now a major problem. And it's very hard to find a physician who knows much about Lyme disease, and the reason is that most medical boards really go after physicians that treat these Lyme patients that have the long-term Lyme problem, and it requires generally a long course of multiple antibiotics and other drugs to treat these types of infections, and medical boards will actually try and remove the license of a physician that effectively treats things like Lyme disease. And we don't know about things like Morgellons because it's so new, but already medical boards have been taking a look very carefully at the physicians that treat Morgellons disease.
Hold that thought right there. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney, Dr. Nicholson was pointing out that many of the medical boards will really go after doctors who treat Lyme disease. And, of course, it requires long-term antibiotics, and for some reason, there is a conscious effort to discourage doctors from treating this disease, which has probably almost a million people have Lyme disease. There are Lyme disease support groups, and these people, if you talk to them, they'll tell you who the doctors are treated, but the doctors have to do it very surreptitiously, or they will lose their medical license. Why would you go after a doctor who's trying to help people, and in many instances is helping people? Certainly Dr. Nicholson raises the issue, will they go after the people who try to treat Morgellons disease? I mean, are they going to be targeted as well? Somebody had asked if there's any place for the use of ozone in treatment of any of these diseases. Is there any evidence that suggests that ozone treatment, which is frowned on by the medical boards and by the government, is beneficial for people with these degenerative neurological diseases?
Actually, it can help some people, particularly if they have the types of intracellular bacteria that we were discussing previously that seem to be sensitive to oxygen treatment. A lot of these conditions favor low oxygen. In other words, if people fly in airlines, take long trips, they often relapse with these diseases, and that's kind of a symptom that low oxygen tension seems to stimulate them. So that these oxygen treatments, such as hyperbaric oxygen, ozone therapy, or even in some cases hydrogen peroxide, although it's really quite dangerous unless somebody really knows what they're doing, those types of treatments have actually proven beneficial. And we're not sure about the Morgellons disease, but some of these have been tried in Morgellons patients and have given them some relief, at least short-term relief. The problem is that there's absolutely no one that's working on a systematic cure for any of these diseases. A lot of this is sort of patchwork that's come out of trying different things, as often medical science does, trial and error, to see what works and what doesn't. Because there's really no support to run a major clinical trial on any of these types of diseases to see if there are any effective treatments. And that's a part of the problem. The mainstream medicine is totally ignoring a lot of these problems. And there are millions and millions of people that now have Lyme disease or mycoplasma or various autoimmune diseases caused by intracellular bacteria or some of these parasitic problems. And they just don't know where to get help.
Well, Chris, there's a wonderful book. It was called Ulcerous Web, written by, I think it was Hillary Johnson. And, of course, she had chronic fatigue. And it was the story of the chronic fatigue and a syndrome. And, of course, the efforts by the people with this. Literally a million people have this disease. And the pressure that they brought on Congress, you know, to authorize the CDC to study it. And so the Congress would authorize the money. And then the CDC would use it for psychiatric evaluation or funnel the money off to other things. The CDC absolutely refused to try to find out what the cause of chronic fatigue was in fibromyalgia, which overlaps. And you have to ask yourself, why, when the money is authorized, would they spend all the money on psychiatric analysis rather than trying to get to the cause of these terrible diseases that afflict so many Americans?
Well, I'm afraid the same thing is going to be repeated with Morgellons disease, that they'll approach this as a psychiatric problem rather than a real medical problem. And we think it's quite the opposite, because people aren't doing this to themselves. There's something very real that's there, and unfortunately there's no resources to investigate it. And there are a few physicians and a few scientists around the country who are trying to investigate it on a shoestring, but they really have no support, they have no help, and they're being shunned by their colleagues for even approaching these kinds of problems.
Well, I've actually seen some pictures of this this critter, whatever it is, whether it's bacteria, insect, or pest, or certainly some sort of insect or pest. Anyway, parasite, I guess, would be the term. Have they actually gotten, are these pictures legitimate that are up on the Internet?
Well, there are a number of different websites that you can go to actually see pictures of what these things look like, or what supposedly the organisms that are producing the fibers look like. And there's some mention that these sorts of organisms, whatever they are hybrid organisms that have elements of insect, elements of bacteria, elements of parasites. And frankly, we just don't know, because, again, the detailed genetics haven't been done, but I wouldn't be surprised if these turned out to be unusual hybrids with unusual genetic makeup.
Well, don't many of these people actually commit suicide because it is really so distressing for them?
Well, that's true. I mean, the end result is that people that can't get any help, and nobody believes that they're sick, and are just tearing at themselves, and finally some of them just give up.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is a terrible, terrible tragedy. It's not imaginary, it's real. And these things are going on in America today. And unfortunately, the average doctor can't believe it, because, of course, the people who run organized medicine claim it doesn't exist. Well, there's Dr. Stan back here. We're talking about these chronic disabling illnesses, the chronic intracellular illnesses that plague so many people today, and there seems to be an overlap of the mycoplasm between chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and Lyme disease. And is there an element of these in Morgellons as well?
There is. In fact, many of the people that have Morgellons disease have also been diagnosed with Lyme disease. They've also been diagnosed with the Borrelia burgdorferi and the mycoplasma and other microbes as well. So the interesting thing is that there's actually, rather than these small intracellular bacteria and so on that we associate with Lyme disease, in the case of Morgellons, there's a much larger organism that's involved that may harbor some of these infectious agents, but this is the weird hybrid that has elements of insect and parasite and so on, and they actually have a structure that's visible, certainly if not under the naked eye, by a low-power microscopy, and fibers seem to be extruded from these structures. And some of the patients call these tubular structures because they can actually pull them out with the fine forceps, like they're pulling a worm out of their skin. So these are the sort of structures that live in the wounds that form from the Morgellons disease and the same wounds that extrude the fibers and so on. So there's a real mystery here, and I think that people that really start investigating this have to have a very open mind, because this is not, I don't think, present naturally. I think this is an unnatural creation.
Well, of course, the big thing is, of course, how do you get the grant to go ahead and do the studies on this? Of course, the major universities have money, but apparently they're loath to use it. Certainly they go to government agencies of one sort or another. And you can get the government grants, fine, but if you're studying something that the government doesn't want you to study, the money just isn't available. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Well, I think it's a very fair appraisal, and we've learned that ourselves the hard way when we started looking at the infections associated with the Gulf War veterans and their family members who came down with similar diseases after the veterans returned back to the family units. But there was absolutely no funding whatsoever. In fact, they purposely excluded us from any funding, and when pressure was put by Congress to fund research in the area, the funding all went to other laboratories that really had secondary interest in this, but the labs that were really focusing on this never got a penny. And that's typical.
Of course, I think this really suggests that there is an organized effort to block research in this field. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, certainly one of our favorite guests, and always informative about these chronic intracellular diseases that are plaguing so many Americans, and of course there's no money available for research for them. Any effort to try to find out what's really going on is being actively discouraged, and you have to ask yourself why. Well, before we go on, Dr. Nicholson, would you like to get out your website, how people can get more information on these subjects? And you want to put in a plug for your book. Of course, we do carry a book, Project Daylily, but it's one of the most fascinating adventure stories you've ever read. Only you actually lived this experience, didn't you?
We did, and Project Daylily is actually the true story of what happened to us when we stumbled across some of these experimental programs in the prison system and in the military to develop essentially new incapacitating biological warfare agents and test them on unknowing populations. And this is the story of what was really done to us personally, and what happened to some of my colleagues, some of whom were killed because of this. So it's a very serious problem of bringing this information to light, and the book is one way that we can spread information. And, you know, I've always said truth is your strongest weapon. Well, this is something that, you know, we could be very truthful in the book, but we had to change the names of the individuals that we named in the book and the institutions. That's about the only thing that was changed, but we had to do that because we could just see ourselves facing, you know, 100 frivolous lawsuits to try and just totally stymie any of our efforts and keep us in the courtroom night and day trying to fight these endless lawsuits. And we went through a period where that actually happened as well. It actually happened after the end of the period that the book covers, but nonetheless, that was a very troubling and difficult time for us. But we got through that, and other people have been through the experiences as well. So Project Daylily, which is carried by Dr. Stan and people, I urge them to get that book because it's very illuminating about how some of these programs get started and what happens when they get out of control. And the effort that's expended, much more effort is expended trying to cover this information up and prevent the research and prevent people from being helped than whatever happened if they would just admit it and then go ahead and effectively try and develop the antidotes and help the people that were afflicted.
But, of course, they really cannot admit that they are working on these chronic disabling diseases because we've signed treaties saying we wouldn't do that. And since we've tried signed treaties, why, we cannot admit that we're lying. The government, a certain element within the government, is lying and is pursuing the development of these terrible chronic diseases. And, of course, these things get out of the laboratory, and the next thing you know, they permeated our whole society and literally millions of Americans are disabled. How do you admit you violated the law? These would be capital crimes if they ever were taken before the world court, and so everything has to be cover up, even if it means killing people. And that's the story that you'll get out of Operation Daylily.
Project Daylily.
And, of course, we do carry the book. You'll find it fascinating.
If people would like to find information about these sort of diseases that we've been discussing, they can go on the website of the Institute for Molecular Medicine. That's where we conduct some of the research. It's a nonprofit, the research organization. The website is www.immed.org, like a media.org. And there they can find information about some of these unusual diseases that we've been discussing, Lyme disease, the mycoplasma, infections that cause autoimmune and neurodegenerative diseases, Morgellons disease, and so on and so forth. So hopefully that is a site that the people, if they want further information, can go to that and download a number of publications. There are approximately 100 publications that you can download from there. So we've tried to build the site mostly on peer-reviewed medical publications rather than fluff. So that's something that's a little bit different in our site compared to other websites that you'll go to.
And really, of course, I think it's vitally important that people understand if you have these chronic diseases, you have to get your immune system built up. And certainly the antibiotics and certainly those things are important. But the major thing is that your body can take care of a lot of this if you can develop your immune system. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, we have a lot of information there about the things that people can do to, for example, boost their immune systems, which are often compromised with these infections. There are also some other things that happen. For example, we've discussed in some of your programs the fact that our mitochondria, the little energy systems, the little batteries inside our cells that provide the energy to make our cells work, are being destroyed slowly by these chronic infections and these agents. And we've actually performed some clinical trials on natural products that can actually be used to help repair the mitochondrial membranes and boost up the energy of the cells, and very effective products that are now going worldwide. And so there's some information on the website. The actual clinical trials are summarized on the website, and we're conducting some additional clinical trials. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to get one started using troops that were deployed to Afghanistan that have to operate in high altitude. Again, this is one of the problems, that you get to high altitude and you're much more susceptible to many of these diseases. They cause tremendous difficulties because they attack your mitochondria, the little energy, the little batteries inside your cells, and other structures in the cells that provide you with the energy that you need to operate under, for example, high altitude strenuous conditions.
Well, Chris, now, are the young men coming back from Afghanistan and from Iraq today as prone to illness as they were those who came back from the first Gulf War? My understanding is almost 30% of the returnees from Iraq and Afghanistan within 3 months of returning home are ill with some sort of a disease of some sort. And And the government isn't very interested in finding out what it is. They just put them on Prozac, which is a terrible disease. And then they go out and either get suicidal or they end up killing somebody because certainly there's a aberrant reaction for some people with the Prozac as you raise the serotonin levels and they do become homicidal and suicidal. But, you know, do we have any idea what is causing the disease in so many of our returning servicemen?
Well, in some cases, we have an idea. For example, after the first Gulf War, we knew that 40% of the sick veterans, and by the way, there was a large number of sick veterans, almost 20% of the veterans that were deployed became sick, and there were many deaths. Even the VA would admit to approximately 10,000 after the first Gulf War within a few years, but that number went up to in excess of 28,000. That's the last number that we could get our hands on. And the reason that these people, you know, with chronic diseases end up with a life-threatening situation is that these chronic diseases progress and they end up involving more and more organ systems. And when the cardiovascular system is involved, that's a trigger that changes it from a chronic illness to something that could be an acute problem. It could lead to premature heart attacks, for example, and strokes and other cardiovascular problems. And this is the one thing that we found with the returning veterans from the first Gulf War. They were at much higher risk for coronary heart problems, even at a very young age, less than 25 years old, where that's just unheard of. To have people that were not only in good health, because they had to be in good health to be deployed, they passed physicals, they were young, they were strong, they were in good health, in good condition. They were deployed, they came back, and they became sickly, and many of them died. And again, a lot of this has been covered up. But the fact of the matter is that they had a lot of problems when they came back. Some of them autoimmune, some of them neurodegenerative, some of them cardiovascular. And the ones with the neurodegenerative and the cardiovascular problems were the ones that they were most at risk for a fatal disease. And it's unfortunate that it happened, and it's happening again, not quite in the numbers that we saw in the first Gulf War, because I think they learned a lesson about using our veterans, our deployed forces as guinea pigs. So they were a little, I think they were more careful on this new round of wars that we're fighting. But we're still seeing casualties, and I think they're still up to their tricks.
And, of course, one of the things you mentioned that about 40% of the veterans of the first Gulf War, you know, had mycoplasma. Didn't a lot of their families get it as well, their wives? And didn't some of their children then get it and become autistic? What was that all about?
Well, that's exactly what happened, and we started studying families because the families became sick, and the adults and the teenagers and the families usually were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, which are fatiguing illnesses similar to what the veterans had. But the younger children, they came down with autistic spectrum disorders, so attention deficit disorder, Asperger's syndrome, autism, all these fit under the rubric of the ASD, or Autistic Spectrum Disorders. And it's interesting because we found that 90% of these children had the same infection as their adult parent, and they didn't have this before the Gulf War. This happened after the Gulf War. They became autistic after the veteran came back and spread the infection in the family. So then we started looking at civilians. Is there a counterpart in the civilian population? So we went into areas of Central California where there's a very high incidence, for example, of autistic spectrum disorders. And sure enough, we found there was a very high percentage of those children had very similar infections. Not quite the same, but very similar types of infections, and often multiple infections. And we know in Lyme-intense areas that the Borrelia burgdorferi and the associated mycoplasma and other infections are very prominent in these autistic spectrum disorders. So there's a subset of the autism and similar cases that are actually Lyme disease cases. And also there's a very prominent subset that are mycoplasmal infection cases and so on. So we now know that these are, you know, prominent in those particular segments of the population that have these unusual childhood diseases, which, by the way, we never saw in any great incidents, 20, 40 years ago. This is something that's fairly recent, and it's increasing in incidence. And it all, a lot of it, people have found, seems to correlate with the multiple vaccines that are received by the school-age children before they're admitted into school. They have to have, in some cases, as many as 25 or 30 different vaccines. And any one of those vaccines alone may be safe, but when they're all given together, as they often are, they're not so safe anymore. And that's kind of what we've been seeing. And it may have a parallel with what happened during the Gulf War when during deployment, most of these people that were in good health, they had to be deployed, were given as many as 20 to 30 different vaccines within a very short period of time. And again, a number of those came down sick later on, whether they were in a war zone or not. It's just they could be deployed and be sitting on a ship in the Persian Gulf 100 miles or more from any action on the ground, and yet still come down with Gulf War illness. So now all of a sudden translate that into what the children are receiving in terms of vaccines and the number of vaccinations and so on, which are very immune-suppressing, that if there's any minor contaminant in one of those vaccine lots, or if they're exposed to any minor difficulty by an airborne route, let's say, they all of a sudden are now, they're susceptible, whereas before they were completely healthy and completely resistant. So we think that this may play a role in a lot of these childhood illnesses.
Well, does the mercury in the vaccines that we used to have in many of our vaccines, does that in any way suppress the immune system?
Oh, yes, it does, and it itself causes the problem. Now, most of these illnesses, whether we're talking about Gulf War illness or talking about autism or attention deficit disorder and so on, there are multiple reasons for the problems. It's not just one reason. So it's not just infections, or it's not just mercury, or it's not just chemical exposures or whatever. There seem to be multiple reasons, and part of it has to do with suppressing the immune system. Part of it has to do with these infections. Part of it has to do with the toxicity and the burden of chemicals and so on and so forth. So if you look at areas where these types of diseases are rampant, these are often areas where there's a lot of chemical use, a lot of spraying going on, for example. There's contamination in the water supply, contamination in the food supply. People are exposed to a lot of infections and so on. And so it all kind of goes hand in hand in our modern environment where we're exposed to so many toxic materials. It just kind of overloads our systems and leaves us very susceptible to these infectious agents.
Well, you know, really what a tragedy it is when we have more and more of our children coming down with these illnesses. And it's estimated that maybe one in six American children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality. We never used to see that, and we certainly don't see it among the autism children where they don't take the vaccine. So, I mean, but everything is done to discourage anybody from talking about this sort of thing or really to conceal the truth from the American people. I think that's unconscionable. I just read an editorial in the Washington Post about, I mean, all these poor, deluded parents of autistic children who thought that the vaccines were responsible. The government has no idea what is responsible for autism. They're concerned about it. But they can guarantee that there's nothing in the vaccines responsible. That's why we've got to continue vaccinating. How could they possibly make such absurd statements and be able to reach literally millions of people with things that just are not true?
Well, here's an example. Children can receive as many as 30 vaccines before they go to school. But when they study these, they don't study the effect of 30 different vaccines on the health problems of children. They study the effect of a vaccine. And they say that this vaccine is safe, therefore this could be added to the regimen of vaccines. And the problem is that one vaccine alone may be completely innocuous, you know, not cause any problems at all, but put in another 28 different other vaccines, and all of a sudden you have a problem. And one of those problems is that these multiple vaccines are very immunosuppressive, and this can allow these children to get opportunistic infections. Or can allow them, for example, if they're exposed to chemicals, to not detoxify those chemicals as readily as they did in the past. Or if they're exposed to heavy metals, in some cases, in the vaccines themselves, that this is going to cause problems. So all these tend to be additive in some complex way that we don't really understand and cause eventually the problem or the disease process.
Well, I think one of the most significant things that I've learned is the fact that vaccines are immunosuppressive. In other words, they tend to suppress the immune system. And if you took one, why, that's bad. But you took 10 or 15 of them, you've got a major insult to the whole immune system. Would that be a fair appraisal?
That's a fair appraisal, and I think that this is actually what happens. And, you know, most of the physicians, for example, pediatricians, are being pushed to truncate the immunization schedules and put more and more vaccines together into more, you know, polyvalent types of vaccines, and I think this is a mistake.
And, of course, the other thing is, of course, the HMOs, they don't want a lot of visits for the kids. They want to, of course, get them in and give them a full 10 different vaccines all in one day. That's why they only have to pay for one visit.
That's exactly right.
Well, what harm do they do to the child? And, well, that's not really the problem with the HMO. The HMO is it's all about money. It's not about health. And this is why we've really got problems today with what's going on in the vaccination programs. But who's going to speak for the child? Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, immed.org. Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, Garth.
Well, I'd like to, let's go back to what we started with, which was our book, Project Daylily. And this really kind of informs people as to what goes on behind the scenes in terms of the experimentation on the American public, on the prisoners, on military recruits, on people that really don't know what's going on and have no recourse and have no ability to take care of themselves or to get proper treatment. And then going from there, once these things get loose, they penetrate into the population. So, you know, civilians that don't have anything to do with the prisons or the military or whatever experimentation, all of a sudden they're being exposed just because they're coming in contact with individuals that carry these diseases. Or they're coming in contact with for example, insects that are carrying the disease, as in the case of Lyme disease. And so once these things get loose, you know, once they're out of the bottle, you can't put them back in the bottle. And so we really have to really start programs that look at these problems systematically and come up with some real solutions. And this is going to require a lot of effort, and unfortunately this effort is not being undertaken. In fact, if anything, most of this work is being covered up, and most of the problem is being ignored. And that's the tragedy, because once you ignore the problem, it just penetrates further and further into the population, and more people get sick, more and more people ultimately are going to die because of the decisions that are being made.
And of course, we should be able to trust our people working at the CDC, but I've been there, I've talked to the people, and I will tell you, after spending several days at the Centers for Disease Control, although I did meet some dedicated public servants who really were trying to do the right thing, I met people who had an entirely different agenda. And I really am very, very concerned that the U.S. Public Health Service, the CDC, many of our government agencies have people in key positions who are not interested in preserving the health of the public. And certainly Dr. Nicholson has some excellent material. We recommend you go to his website, www.immed, that you get his book. It's entitled Project Daylily. That's Project Daylily. And then, of course, we have something called the Rockefeller Report. It's basically a report from the Veterans Administration back in 1994, talking about all the experiments that had been done on Americans, and specifically on military personnel. We call it the Rockefeller Committee Report. Garth, thanks very much for being with us again. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks again, Stan.
Good night. God bless. And we'll be back in just a minute to wrap up tonight's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you, learn something from Dr. Nicholson every time we have him. He's certainly one of my favorite guests. I always learn things from him. He's been on the front lines of this scientific battle. He has over 600 peer-reviewed articles, and, of course, we've checked them out very, very thoroughly before we would ever have him on the program. Certainly, we've met him personally. We believe, he is getting the information out that's true. If you'd like to get the Rockefeller Committee report, it's a report from the Veterans Administration. We do carry that. In fact, I called the U.S. printing office after the report came back out in 1994, asked them how many copies they had. They said they'd only printed I think it was 35 for the entire country of 300 million. Now, they did give copies out to the members of the committee that put this Senate committee, but for the general population, 35 copies. When I asked why, they said, well, it was so difficult to copy and to print these up, so expensive. So we bought up 25 copies, and we sold those. We now produce them ourselves. But it's the Rockefeller Committee report. You need to get it. You need to get Project Daylily. Let me suggest my talk on None Dare Call It Genocide. None Dare Call It Genocide. And then my DVD on the planned population reduction. Ladies and gentlemen, there really are people out there who want to dramatically reduce the world population. We have another talk on video. It's called Population Control. We've written something called the Population Control Agenda Monograph. If you want to know where the AIDS virus came from, the book Emerging Viruses, which we carry, all of these are vitally important. That's Emerging Viruses by Dr. Len Horowitz. I think it's an excellent book. And, of course, there are people who actually have been involved in production of these terrible new illnesses. There's a book called Final Disclosure. I believe the title of it by Gary. I can't remember the author's name, but anybody wants it, we can get it. Or you can look up Final Disclosure on the Internet. We don't carry the book. But it was based upon the testimony of a gentleman who has worked in these laboratories to create these terrible diseases, including AIDS. And he was dying of pancreatic carcinoma, so he actually went to, it was Gary Glum, to Gary Glum, Dr. Gary Glum, and told him about what he'd done, and hoping perhaps to repent, as he's about to face his maker. Ladies and gentlemen, they have laboratories, secret laboratories where they're working on all of this, and then they will use the open laboratories. And those of you who have not heard my interviews with Don Scott, you need to get them. They have open laboratories where they actually pay scientists to do scientific work. But each part of the puzzle, of course, no scientist realizes what the other ones are doing as they create these terrible new diseases. But they don't understand that what they have done is only part of this. It's only those people who put them all together and creating the new diseases to plague mankind. We do not carry the book Between Two Ages, but you get it, written by Zygmunt Brzezinski, and somewhere between page 55 and 65, I think it's about 59, or maybe it's 65, don't hold me to it. At the footnote at the bottom of the page, they talked about how in the future they're going to be able to create storms and droughts, they're going to be able to modify the weather, and they're going to be able to create these terrible new chronic diseases to disable the enemy. Ladies and gentlemen, you and I are the enemy of the elite, and where Zygmunt Brzezinski works for David Rockefeller, he has certainly done more to bring about the Al-Qaeda movement. He was the one who single-handedly created the war, the Afghan war, where, of course, they recruited the Muslim warriors throughout the world to go to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, and then when the war ended, that was the basis of Al-Qaeda. And, of course, Zygmunt Brzezinski, writing back in 1970, in Between Two Ages, described how they're going to be able to modify the weather and then, of course, how they're going to be able to actually create these terrible new diseases. You need to get our 4-tape set on weather modification. The DVD we have on weather modification, the book on weather modification. Understand they can change the weather. They know exactly how to do it. Get our 4-tape sets on chemtrails, and please, of course, remember our number 1-800-544-8927.